everybody. I'm Beatty Cohn-Fredos, and welcome again, my friends, to the Ask Beatty Show. And I am so excited to actually be at the Progressive Radio Network studio. It's been 2.5 years, and it is so nice to be able to meet a lot of the new staff, the producers, who really take such good care of all of us. And for those of you who may be actually tuning in for the very first time and you're wondering, who is Beatty Cohn-Fredos and what is the Ask Beatty Show really all about? Well, I am a psychotherapist and a sex therapist, and I am the author of the groundbreaking book, For Better, For Worse, Forever, Discover the Path to Lasting Love. Believe me, it is a book that I wish I had had when I was beginning my own dating and relationship life. And the book teaches us all how to assess. Yes, assess. I know that it is not a sexy or romantic term, but it is critical when it comes to really finding out who our partner is and who our partner is not. I'm also the advice columnist for Dan's Papers in the Hamptons and also in Palm Beach. I'm a national speaker, national radio and television expert guest, and I have a private practice here in very, very beautiful and sunny New York City and East Hampton. So people ask me all the time, so what is your show really, really all about? Well, in one word, it is about empowerment. We talk about all of the things that we can do, yes, do, not just think about, not just dream about, not just wish about, to improve the quality of our lives and the quality of our relationships. So, of course, we talk about mental health issues and sexuality and relationships and how and what, again, to do to maximize our physical and emotional and psychological well-being despite the stressors of life. And of course, I say this all the time, that nobody is immune from life's ups and downs. And, you know, I've been hosting the Ask Beatty Show now, and I can hardly believe it's over 8 years. And I really, really hope that I have convinced you that it is okay. It is more than okay to reach out and ask for help when life is really not going all that well. Now, hopefully, you are fortunate to have family and friends who you can contact, who you can Zoom with, who you can get together with, who you can talk with. And if you don't, the very, very best thing that you can really do is reach out and get some good, good professional help, because life is just too challenging to think that we need to navigate this journey on our own. Because when we're looking at really what is going on in the country, we have 17 million adults in the United States who are suffering from depression. And I think that number is probably low. And 40 million Americans are suffering from a variety of anxiety disorders. If you're looking at domestic violence, 3 women, yes, this is what I am saying. 3 women are killed every single day by their so-called intimate partner. And I was doing some consulting at East Hampton High School a couple of months ago, and just talking with the kids and looking at the teenage dating violence statistics. So listen to these numbers. Nearly 1 in 11 females and approximately 1 in 14 male high school students report having experienced physical dating violence in the last year. About 1 in 8 females and 1 in 26 male high school students also report having experienced sexual dating violence. one in three girls in the United States is a victim of physical, emotional, or verbal abuse from a so-called dating partner. And only 33% of teens who were in an abusive relationship ever told anyone about the abuse. And I think this is an interesting but troubling statistic, that 81% of parents believe that teen dating abuse, teen dating violence is not an issue. And when it comes to college students, and this number is also frightening, that 33% of college co-eds are finding themselves in dating abuse types of relationships. And what I've discovered over the past 35 years, and I can hardly believe that I've actually been practicing as a psychotherapist and sex therapist for the past 35 years, but I've discovered that there are actually three things that we need to do to never make a mistake in love again. Okay? Number one, each of us needs to be in a good place emotionally and psychologically and psychiatrically. And we need to be willing to deal with our depression and our anxiety and our skeletons in the closet, typically beginning with our own family of origins. And I used to tell people all the time that the relationships, as much as we want relationships, as much as we dream of finding our happily ever after, the relationship really does need to be the icing on the cake. And we need to be the cake. We have to do whatever it is that we need to do to get our life in a place where we feel good about ourselves, where we're not entering relationships with poor self-esteem, and where we're hoping that somebody is going to be saving us. So that's number one. Number two, and I say this very, very respectfully, I mean, I've dealt with thousands and thousands of people over the years from every walk of life, rich and poor and black and white and Jewish and Christian and Muslim and gay and straight and trans. And what I have found, that despite all of the self-help books and the talk about mental health and relationships, that the majority of people really, really and truly still do not know what ingredients go into a healthy relationship. And number three is my book. And I did research with 450 people in the Boston, Providence, and Connecticut areas. And as a result of the research, I devised a 10-step formula. And for people who know me, they know I'm very, very bottom line. If it doesn't work, I have absolutely no use for psychobabble and for things that are not going to be bottom line helpful to people. So I came up with this 10-step formula that teaches all of us how to assess who is right for you and who is wrong for you before committing to any serious relationship. So it's kind of like having me in your purse or in your wallet doing a very, very in-depth assessment. The only difference is that what my research found, and I was very upset about this because in my personal life, I'm probably one of the most impatient people that you will ever, ever want to meet. Of course, professionally, I'm extraordinarily patient, but what the research found is that it takes really close to a year to using my formula to find out who somebody is and isn't. And unfortunately, this process cannot be fast forwarded. So before I did the research, I think probably when I was starting out in my own relationship life, I'm a very spontaneous person, or let's say I used to be a very spontaneous person. I would meet somebody and I would say, I've just met this really lovely woman, or I've met this really great guy. And over the years, what I've learned is that I would never, ever, ever make that kind of a comment to me. And, you know, I've recently been doing some consulting at East Hampton High School in East Hampton in New York. And, you know, the thing that was so interesting, you know, with the kids is that I would say to them, okay, you know about my 10-step formula. You know it's going to take about a year to really find out who somebody is and isn't. So what would I say? What would I say if I'm meeting somebody for the very, very first time? So in the old days, I would say, I met a great person. I met a great guy. I met a great woman. And what I've learned, fortunately or unfortunately, to say is that I have met somebody who appears to be wonderful and great. And using my formula, I'm going to find out who they are in about a year. And that happens to be the reality, my friends. So we have to be really, really savvy when it comes to our relationships. We're looking at a divorce rate of first marriages, 48%, 67% of second marriages also end in divorce. And for third marriages, one would hope that we would see some improvement. However, that statistic is 73%. So we clearly need to be doing a much, 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 much better job when it comes to making a decision about who we would like to spend our life with. Well, I am very, very, very excited and honored to have a guest today. And my guest is Dr. Andrew Solomon. And I welcome. I'm so glad to see you. And Dr. Solomon is a professor of clinical psychology at Columbia University Medical Center. He is also a lecturer at Yale School of Medicine and the past president of capital P, capital E, capital N American Center. He is a writer in politics, culture, and psychology, and was included in the Times list of the 100 best books of the decade. And, you know, when I was reading your articles about suicide and depression, and there was something beautiful and empathic about the way you seem to project in the articles, I said to my husband, Jim, I've got to call Dr. Solomon. I need to connect, because I really felt that there was going to be a meeting of the minds. And when I read your article, The Mystifying Rise of Child Suicide, in the April 11th edition of the New Yorker magazine, you're pointing out some very depressing statistics that between 1950, 1988, the proportion of adolescents 15 to 19 who killed themselves dramatically quadrupled. Between 2007 and 2017, the number of children aged 10 to 14 who did so more than doubled. In 2020, according to the CDC, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, suicide claimed the lives of more than 500 children between 10 and 14. They are babies, and 6,000 young adults between 15 and 21. Suicide is the third leading cause of death among people age 15 to 24. So welcome. So what is going on here?
Well, thank you for that warm welcome, and what a pleasure it is to be here today. And I would like to begin by saying that I'm essentially a fairly cheerful person, so we can discuss all of this, but I will try not to be too grim and depressing about it, except that it's a very grim and depressing topic.
Right.
And I've discovered with time that you can speak in a lighthearted way of your own dalliance with depression, but you can't speak in a lighthearted way about the death of other people's children.
Right.
It's not a subject that invites that. I think there are a lot of things going on, and I think nobody has been able to pinpoint really where the problem comes from, and therefore no one has been able to pinpoint what we should do about it. But I will throw out some of the contributing factors.
Great.
Certainly there is the question of the internet and social media, and the relative, on the one hand, the relative isolation in which many people live because they are on their phones at times when a generation ago they would have been talking directly to one another, and then also the levels of online bullying that people experience, which are really appalling. There was just a decision in the UK after my article was published that said that social media companies, several of them were listed, were specifically responsible for the suicide of a young woman who, when they traced her social media history, had been logging on to all kinds of videos that showed you how to kill yourself, that encouraged people to kill themselves, and so on and so forth. Some people are now live streaming their suicide so that other people can watch. So that's all huge. One of the problems, I think, is that we have more and more and more choices than people are equipped to deal with. It started off being more choices in terms of what kind of work we did. It then became more choices in terms of who we married, as boundaries of geography and class ceased to play such an enormous role. And now, it doesn't matter what marriage you're in, it doesn't matter what situation you're in, you were just talking about divorce, everybody has the idea when they're having a problem with their spouse that they could reach into their pocket and swipe to the left or the right or whichever direction it is people swipe in, and that there are an infinite number of possibilities, and people suffer under the illusion that one of them will be perfect.
Yes.
As you know, none of them will be perfect. But I think that's played a huge contributing role. I think that world events have been, in many instances, quite painful and quite difficult. And it used to be, even when I was growing up, and I'm 59, my dad read the paper in the morning, and my mom and I watched the evening news in the evening. And my dad probably read it for half an hour, and then we sometimes talked about it. And the evening news was another half an hour. Now, my cell phone, probably 11 times in the course of the 3 minutes we've been talking, has sort of blurted out some other horrible thing that happened somewhere, because good news doesn't sell and bad news does sell. And so there's that. The thing that people who've survived suicide attempts, who are in that age range, most frequently quote is their sense that the world is falling apart. Mm-hmm. They feel that we have destroyed the physical planet and that there's no way to fix it. They, in many instances, are concerned with issues of racism. The group in which the rate of suicide is going up most rapidly is among black children. Mm-hmm. And I think also that there's been a desensitization to the idea of killing and thereby the idea of death. The suicide rate in the United States of gun suicide is twice as high as the rate of gun homicide. Mm-hmm. That's twice as many people who kill themselves by suicide with guns. Guns are proliferating all over the place in the United States, and that is playing a significant role in that escalating level, and the proliferation of guns and the way that people go and practice on targets with their guns desensitizes people to the act of killing. And once you, as somebody who was working with the military, where it's a necessary process to desensitize people to the act of killing, as a psychologist who'd worked there said to me, if you desensitize people to the act of killing other people, you desensitize them to the act of killing themselves. Mm-hmm. So all of those things are coming together. And then there are the big cultural movements. You know, the rate of suicide is lower among people of faith. I'm not a person of faith myself, but I think a lot of people have very little sense of purpose in a kind of post-religious world, or they subscribe to religions in which the prescriptions are so extensive and so intrusive that they feel they can never live up to them and that they failed. The rate of suicide is highest among LGBTQ people of faith. I think the proliferation of sexualities and the growth in that area, and I say this as a gay person myself, is huge. And I think that there's a lot of anger within families. I'll tell you just two very quick stories, and then I'll stop talking so you can talk.
No, keep talking, Dr. Solomon. Keep talking. What you're saying is so, it's so informative, and it's true, and it's important that listeners hear the reality of what is really going on.
I interviewed someone a few weeks ago who had made a suicide attempt He came from a well-educated family of people who sort of should know how to deal with things. He was on the psychiatric unit at one of the best hospitals in the country. The person on the unit who was working with him said, "You might be the most depressed person we've ever had on this unit." This guy said to his father, who came to visit, he said, "Wow," he said, "they said I'm probably the most depressed person they've ever seen on the unit." And his father said, "Well, at least you're good at something."
Wow.
I mean, we don't realize sort of how invidious this kind of thing is. And a friend of mine who answers phones at the Trevor Project, which is set up to respond to LGBTQ youth who are considering suicide as a sort of hotline, described how he had someone who called him. You know, many of the calls are not like this, but someone who called him and said, "I need your advice." He said, "I'm 14. He said, "I just came out to my parents." He said, "My father said, your mother and I are going to leave the house now. The gun is on the kitchen table.
Wow.
You know what you should do." So there are attitudes within families. There's a breakdown of a certain decency and civility.
Yes.
I think that's also come partly of the internet. Mm-hmm. So there are a million other reasons, but there are some to get started with.
Mm-hmm. You know, in describing your own childhood, you know, sitting down with your father, watching the news with mom, I mean, look at what's happened to the family. I mean, you grew up in a two-parent family. I grew up in a two-parent family, and I was lucky enough, and I know we both had very good relationships with our fathers, because I read a bunch of things about you in your bio. And I know that when I didn't suffer from clinical depression, but I had my ups and downs like every kid. And my dad knew exactly what he needed to do with me. He got me on the tennis courts. I was very active physically. Was the only Jewish kid in Canada. I was number 10 in Canada as a Jewish tennis player. Right. And that was a whole other thing. Being Jewish in a completely waspy world. Never. And I can't even believe that I'm saying this, but it's true. Never invited to anybody's birthday party. I mean, I was...
Wow.
No. And I only thought about that, Dr. Solomon, a number of years ago as I was looking at, you know, my sports accolades. I mean, I played national badminton and tennis, and I was a figure skater, and this was a very unusual thing for a Jewish girl who came from an Orthodox family to be doing. But I was never included socially in that world. So, you know, fortunately, you know, growing up in an Orthodox world, I had the whole Orthodox community behind me. But it could have been a very, very, very dicey time for me as a child if I didn't have the Orthodox community and if I didn't have my parents, and I'm an only child, to support me in having a social life and a life outside of the sports, because I had no friends. And I hadn't thought about it that much in my world of sports, where I spent a lot of time.
Well, you must be a very profoundly resilient person, and the fact that you have blue eyes and beautiful blonde hair doubtless helped
you
in those situations. But yes, I think that one of the huge issues is the amount of attention that children are able to get from their parents.
Yes.
There was a study done with younger children on depression rather than suicide by Myrna Weissman up at Columbia, and she tested 7 different ways of dealing with children who were depressed. And she found the most successful way was to treat their mothers.
Absolutely.
You know, if the parents are not in a good place, then that makes for a lot of trouble. And look, there are all kinds of parents now where both parents work. That's fairly standard now. You know, my mother was a stay-at-home mom. She was a brilliant woman. I think she could have done all kinds of other things that might have been interesting to her. I think if she lived now, she would probably have quite a different life. She also loved being a mother and was an amazing, attentive mother. But the financial way that we were and lived was such that she had the leisure to do that. And nowadays, I think if you have two parents who both have high-pressure jobs, they are working all day, there is no one there to greet you when you get home from school, there is nobody who sort of stays home with you on the day that you have a bad cold and just can't quite manage to deal with going in, all of that coming apart. And because of geographical mobility, your grandmother is probably five states away, and your cousins all live in Utah, and whatever it is, wherever people have been scattered, there isn't as much support structure. And the support structures that we've provided are bad around the world, but the state of childcare in the United States and the unavailability of decent childcare and the unavailability of decent early education and the lack, unless you're, you know, rich enough to afford a full-time nanny, which most people, frankly, aren't, the lack of individualized attention to a child, all of that has very toxic effects. It starts early.
No, exactly. And this is where, you know, I was reading something that you had either been quoted or that you wrote. This is where the schools have such a profound, profound opportunity. And I think I had mentioned to you that when I finished my postgraduate work at McGill in Montreal, I started off as a school social worker in the inner city school. And I had this caseload, and I visited the families, and no child was really left behind. We didn't have a million schools. We were able to have a reasonable caseload. And then a couple of years after, I was promoted to one of the directors of the entire school social services program for Greater Montreal. And it was an amazing experience to see how the teachers, the superintendents, the psychologists, I mean, we really worked together as a cohesive unit. The teachers, I mean, my staff would go in and they would educate the teachers about what to look for. Yes, little Johnny is very quiet, but that doesn't mean that little Johnny is okay. And the person who is, you know, being very disruptive, yeah, he may, or she may have a problem too, but that's not ignore little Johnny. So everybody was on board and really clued in to mental health issues. And it was an amazing program. I mean, it wasn't perfect. Of course, nothing is ever perfect, but there was early identification and early intervention beginning at the first grade level.
There is now, of course, the huge problem of the American insurance system and whether people can get the care for their children, even if they know enough to want it.
Right.
There is the problem that there is a huge shortage of child psychologists. Yeah. It is not a well-paid area, and of child psychiatrists. In fact, in some areas of the country, there is one child psychiatrist for every 30,000 children.
Yeah, that's absurd.
You know, I find taking care of my two children quite demanding. The idea
right.
of taking care of 30,000 sounds, you know, obviously completely impossible. There is the problem that depression in childhood, and not all suicide is related to depression, but an awful lot of it is, depression in childhood manifests in one of two ways, either by hyperactive acting out or by withdrawal, just as you were saying.
Right.
Especially in communities of color and disadvantaged populations. The kids who act out are dealt with not with counseling, but by being sent to disciplinary situations. And the children who are totally withdrawn aren't making any trouble and they're left to sit quietly in the back corner.
Right.
And so even in schools where we could have effective screening protocols, we don't have them. And the language of emotional literacy, which has evolved so much over these past few decades. You know, it used to be that, I don't know, only Tolstoy or Virginia Woolf could manage to express the inner life. We now all know the basic language. It isn't, emotional literacy is not being taught in schools. I mean, not much is being taught in many schools in this country, alas. And I speak as a patriot for this country. These are just deficits that I find heartbreaking because I don't think they would be so incredibly difficult to fix. And I think the cost of losing those thousands and thousands and thousands of lives every year, it's such a terrible cost to pay. If there were suddenly a sort of new pandemic and we said, oh, it mostly affects children and 40,000 children a year will die from it, or even 8,000 children a year will die from it, you know, all hands would be on deck and we'd have some kind of Operation Warp Speed. Here we have a problem. We know some of the solutions.
We're
not doing a thing about it.
Right. And again, it's not about, I don't think it's about money at all. It's about caring. I mean, I can't believe, I'll tell you a little vignette that's happened recently. I have a program, Never Make a Mistake in Love Again. It's based on my research, it's based on my book, it's evidence-based. It teaches people how to assess who's right for you and who's wrong for you before committing to any serious relationship, okay? So for fun, and I've given hundreds and hundreds of presentations around the country and in Canada. So for fun, recently, Jim and I, my husband, who's a sociologist and criminologist, said, you know what? I am going to start to call schools. And I have a private practice here and in East Hampton, and I'm busy, and I have the radio and the TV. So it's not like I'm looking for extra work. So I called Dr. Solomon 10 private schools here in New York. And I'm citing the teenage violence statistics and the co-ed statistics and what's going on in you know, dating relationships, the reality. And I got to tell you, nobody was interested. Nobody really cared at all. And these are schools. I mean, certainly the money was there, and I haven't contacted the public school system. But I will, just to see if there would be an interest in teaching the kids about healthy relationships. But then some good news that I happened to really come upon was East Hampton High School. East Hampton High School is a place unto itself. The principal, Sarah Smith, is a new principal. The superintendent, Adam Fine, was the principal of East Hampton High School, who is a real mensch. The teacher who I have been working with, so I was consulting every Thursday for 5 weeks for 5 hours. So I met hundreds and hundreds of kids. And the school is completely committed to wellness and mental health. So I was there working along with Jim Stewart, the health coordinator, who has been there for over 40 years, teaching the kids about emotions and feelings and how to say it and how to say it well. And it is a model. It's really a model school. And, you know, I was able to, of course, you know, talk about my 10-step formula. And, I mean, the kids are so lucky at this school that they're having an opportunity. And half the school is Hispanic and Black. I would say probably half the school, single-parent families. This is not a wealthy, you know, upper middle-class kind of an environment for the most part. And here is a school. Somehow, the people who are running the school and the superintendent happen to be people who care. Where these other fancy schmancy schools, the kids are doing whatever it is that they're doing and getting prepared for their, you know, Harvards and Yales and all these other schools, and are really, really lacking in the mental health awareness that we are talking about, because I treat these kids and I know where they're at, the isolation and the depression and the suicidal ideation and all this kind of stuff, and they're not getting anything at school. And I would doubt seriously, certainly the kids that I'm working with, they're certainly not getting anything at home.
Well, I think that's absolutely right. And I think it's not only the high-powered schools where they don't care, where they're trying to get the kids into the Ivy League universities. I think it's also a lot of the time public schools in rural here, there, and everywhere. Right. And then we have a really corrupt system. So people always say to me, you had a really bad depression. I was paralyzed with horrifying depression in my early 30s. And they say, but then you seem to have emerged from it, and you have a successful life and a marriage and children and career success, and I feel very lucky, I'm knocking on wood here, that those things have worked out. But they say, I can't get all of that to happen. They say, what was your secret? Mm-hmm. Well, partly my secret was that I was responsive to medication. That made a huge difference. But really, the secret was two things. The first is that I had been very well loved. And mm-hmm. I think that being well loved as a child equips you well. That is not to say that some well loved children don't kill themselves. I was well loved and got very depressed anyway, but it's to say that it gives you a little bit of armor. And the other thing was that we were in New York City and had sufficient means and connections to get me absolutely top quality mm-hmm. care. Mm-hmm. Somebody called me recently who was a friend of the daughter of a friend of my parents, a sort of remote connection, And they had a child in another city, I'm not going to say where, who was had just made a suicide attempt after making several previous ones. And they said, you've been writing about this. They said, we don't know what to do. We're in the emergency room. Do you have any advice for us? And I said, well, given where you are, you should go to such and such a hospital. And they said, okay. And then they called back 10 minutes later and they said, we were told that there's a 6-week waiting
right,
list.
Right, exactly.
They said, a 6-week waiting list, and we have a child who just tried to commit suicide. Right. They said, what are we supposed to do about that? So I said, well, let me call the hospital and see if I can do anything. So I happened to know some people there. Mm-hmm. I called the people at the hospital. I said, look, I said, we really need to get this kid in. I said, how does this waiting list work? What can we do? So on and so forth. And in the end, I spoke with an administrator who said, we'll find a bed for this child tomorrow. She said, but, and I have to tell you, we say a 6-week waiting list because that's what we can say. They said, but between donors and people like you who have academic appointments and are well connected and the other people who have some form of access, they said almost no one gets in off that waiting list.
Right.
Now, I am willing to accept that some people are able to take luxury vacations in Paris and some people aren't. The world is never going to be completely an equal place. I am not willing to accept the idea that mental health is a luxury.
Right.
Not killing yourself and feeling okay and being able to get on with your life is not a luxury. It's a basic human right, and it goes unseen. And in addition to that being unbelievably cruel in humanitarian terms, it's also unbelievably naive in economic terms, because actually people who are functional contribute to the economy, and people who are permanently disabled come with some costs often to the economy or to the people around them. So even if you're heartless enough not to care, there should still be an interest in providing better services to more people, because then you have a more functional population.
Mm-hmm.
The situation we're living with doesn't make sense at any it's like, I don't know, it's like trash collection in Manhattan.
Right.
Just who came up with this system? It doesn't make any sense.
Right. No, I mean, you know, I was thinking, you know, before coming to the studio, and by the way, this is the first time that I have been to the studio in 2.5 years, and I wanted to come today because I wanted to meet you, okay?
Oh.
That was it. I didn't want to do this Zoom thing that I've been doing for all of, you know, for the last 2.5 years.
I'm very honored, and by the way, do call me Andrew, but yes.
Yes, okay, Andrew, definitely, definitely. But, you know, I was treating this 17-year-old boy, who lives in Sag Harbor. And again, weeks and weeks, and he needed psychiatric care. He needed to be on meds. He is bipolar. He had made a number of suicide gestures, slash attempts. And the waiting list, and the stepmother, and the father, and what we did, and what we tried, and the retreat, and, you know, we were all trying to get together and figure out what to do. So finally, he's hospitalized, which is, we thought it was a good thing at the time, and he really did need to just not be at home. So in this hospital, and I'm not going to mention the hospital, I don't want to get sued, they didn't do anything with the kids all day long. And I would, you know, I'd be talking to him. You know, he'd call me, and we would have our little conversations, and I would talk with the stepmother. Nothing was going on. He was medicated. We aren't sure whether or not the medication helped or didn't help. And of course, it was changed in the dose and the kinds and the pills, and it went on and on. And here he was hospitalized for about 6 weeks. And there was not much of anything that was going on in this adolescent hospital.
Psychiatric hospitals are frequently just warehousing facilities.
Yeah.
They can be useful, A, in that they keep you from the physical means you would need to end your own life, and B, because sometimes they figure out your meds while you're there. But for many people, being in a hospital like that, often with people who are more sick than you are, and having nothing to do but shuffle around with them in pajamas all day, turns out to be a trauma in itself.
Yeah.
And often I think it makes people worse. So I think a really good hospitalization, you know, there are good hospitalizations, there are good programs, and it can be helpful. I recently interviewed a therapist who's written a so far unpublished memoir, and we had a long conversation about her daughter, who had gone into an extremely highly regarded hospital, which I likewise won't mention for fear of lawsuits. She gave it a different name, but it's one you would know.
Right.
And her daughter called her and said, I'm feeling really horrible, she said, and they haven't given me my meds. So her mother called the, you know, person in charge and said, my daughter sounds really terrible and I'm really worried. And she also said she didn't have her meds. And the person said, that's ridiculous. Of course she had her meds, he said. And I think what she needs right now is a little bit of separation. And I think you should just let us handle it and we'll be on top of it. Mm-hmm. So over the next 2 days, she had these escalating calls from her daughter saying, I'm feeling so awful. I'm having such a rough time. And I can't get anyone to give me my meds. And this was a child with bipolar illness. And the mother, as a therapist, knew that sometimes distance is what's needed. And she said, look, if it gets really desperate, I'll come up there, but I think you should try to make it work for at least a few more days. And after her daughter killed herself, they were able in a lawsuit to obtain the records.
Yeah.
And no one had given her daughter her meds. And the psychologist who was supposed to be in charge of her case had never met with her. She'd been there for all those days saying she was going to kill herself, and nobody did anything about it. And that was in a kind of super-duper hospital.
Yeah.
I just, you know, again, I feel like there aren't enough treating people. There aren't enough hospitals. The hospitals there are aren't good enough. The programs in schools aren't good enough. All of these things are, you know, they're all fixable.
They are fixable. So what do? We need to join together here, you know, and use our connections and affiliations and the media. You know, what to do? You know, for me, as with you, it's problem solution, you know, trying to figure out how do we manage to change this incredibly horrendous trajectory? What do we do?
I think the first thing we do is to provide a lot more parent education as public service announcements, as some kind of training, as information. You know, most parents these days learn to do CPR so that they can help their child in case of a crisis. You should know how to talk to your child about these basic things. And you should know that, contrary to a sort of folk belief, mentioning the idea of suicide to your children does not cause them to die by suicide. Mentioning the idea of suicide liberates them to say, I do sometimes feel like that, at which point there are a lot of actions to be taken, and you can pursue it from there. So I think the first thing we do is parent education. I think the second thing we do is to say to children, lots of people feel this way. You think you're the only person who's ever felt this way. You say it to the whole class. Mm-hmm. Some of them will have no idea what you're talking about because they're happy-go-lucky. But you say to the whole class, some people have these feelings. They're not unusual. They're not uncommon. It's really important, if you have these feelings, that you come to X designated person at the school whom you can talk to. We'll talk with your parents if you feel you can't talk with them directly, or we won't talk with your parents if you really don't want us to. You know, here are some different ways that we can all address this before. And you make it clear to them that in general, suicide is a permanent solution to a temporary problem, and that the temporary problem can be addressed, and that the suicide, especially among young people, they have no way of knowing what problems are permanent or impermanent. So I think we do all of that, and I think we provide better funding for teachers and for psychologists. I mean, at the moment, you know, I'm delighted that Elon Musk could buy himself Twitter, if that's what he felt like doing. Well, I'm not so delighted, but anyway, he did, and that's fine. But I feel like we pay people so much money for doing a variety of things, including people who are doing things, people like Mark Zuckerberg, who are doing things that are actively dangerous for children, and we can't seem to find any money to be involved in those preventative services. And then finally, we try to make sure that there are some standards set for hospitals and to make it clear that leaving someone who feels suicidal to sit with nothing to do in a room by himself all day is not exactly going to cheer him up.
No, exactly. And I'm looking at an article here that was in the New York Times about this teen was prescribed, 10 psychiatric drugs. You know, she's not alone. You know, that's give another antidepressant. That's give another one. And, the thing that I have found to be just also very, very upsetting, these 30-minute so-called psych evals, these 30-minute therapy or 45-minute, like my mom was a teacher. So I learned in Winnipeg that 1 hour is 60 minutes. So an hour session is for me, and it's, my sessions are 60 minutes. Yeah, that's what an hour is, really. But it is, people are being so shortchanged, even in terms of time. You can't do a psychiatric evaluation, as you well know, in 30 minutes.
No, you can't. And there's actually, I found it quite moving there. Is a couple who had a son who was in a very serious crisis and who I believe had made more than one suicide attempt. And his parents then discovered that the best treatment on the basis of evidence right now for suicidal teens is dialectical behavioral therapy,
yeah,
DBT.
Yes.
But DBT is very expensive and not that many people are trained in it. These parents happen to be relatively privileged. Their son is now doing incredibly well, is successful, is happy, has gone on with his life. It's been years. He's okay. They have contributed a lot of money and raised a lot of money to set up a center at Columbia, mm-hmm. specifically in order to provide DBT to people who otherwise couldn't afford it. And so we need some of that, too. And there's always considered a conflict of interest about asking psychiatric patients for donation. So if you've had a heart transplant and you've recovered and you're doing well and you're rich, right. the hospital is there banging on your door.
Right.
But if you've had schizophrenia and you've emerged from it,
yeah.
they feel like, well, we don't want to sort of intrude. If somebody has yes. enough money to help, tell them, you've gotten better, other people can't get better, come and help us out. There's a lot that could be done. And the stigma that persists around these topics is poisonous, but very real. There's an organization I'm involved with, and somebody who works there had been, I thought, very bravely honest about this, the fact that his son had multiple suicide attempts and that they had brought him through. And again, it's someone who's doing well. There are lots of people who, with good treatment and support, end up being very glad they didn't kill themselves and going on to good lives. I thought this guy was so courageous. He was being considered for a promotion, and at a meeting that I was in, one of the people there, a person of considerable authority, said, I don't know whether we should really, I don't know whether we should really consider him for promotion. He seems kind of together, but his son made all these suicide attempts and things. I'm not sure he's stable enough to take on these additional responsibilities. And I thought, what the hell are you talking right. about? This is someone who has not only managed to do the nearly impossible, which is to take somebody who was really suicidal and get him back on track, but who had the courage to be open and direct and honest and outspoken about it, and who also is performing fantastically well in the job he does. You're really going to not promote him mm-hmm. because he should have kept it all a secret? But it happens. I was in that meeting. I heard it.
Well, talking about therapy and CBT and DBT, I have found over the years, is I'm really curious what you think about this, is that things begin in the beginning, and that we have to help our patients, whether they're kids or adults, process what did and didn't happen in our family of origin. And in going through that process, people are able to emotionally work through things in a way so that they are then, in my view, able to be in the moment, live in the moment for the most part, rather than having one foot in the past and one foot in the present. And then let's do the DBT and the CBT and the meditation and the yoga and everything else. And I have been really appalled at so many people who are in the mental health field in terms of the way they work, and very critical. So very unpopular, I suppose, you know, with potential colleagues. But, you know, look, I've been doing this for a very long time, and I'm very bottom line, and I don't have any use for psychobabble or tricks or anything like that. Either things, they're going to work. And, of course, everybody's an individual, and what works for you may not exactly work for me. But there is a place to begin. And I have found that I don't think I've really met too many therapists, not that I have really sought out too many therapists to meet here, who really have that perspective, that clinical orientation.
There's very inadequate training of
okay.
them. And there's very inadequate humanism. I mean, on the one hand, medications are miraculous. I would not be sitting here today talking to you in this poised way without, or at least I think it's poised, without the medications that I have now been taking for years. I mean, I've readjusted them from time to time, but I've been taking them for years. But the idea of reducing mental health to a set of chemical processes and denying people's real experience of trauma and of loss and of grief, and recognizing there are some people who can live through the Khmer Rouge and actually come out strangely intact. And there are other people who can sort of get pushed down the stairs on the bus once, and they're so shaken by it that they can barely leave the house. That there aren't rules that say this is traumatic and this isn't. Everybody has trauma. Everybody has trauma connected to their family of origin, no matter how nice their family of origin is. Mm-hmm. Everyone struggles with it. Everyone has got elements of self-hatred, and we should be open to that and tolerant of it, and not say, I mean, I became interested in this area because a child who had been at my son's school and had left 2 years earlier ended his life at the age of 12. And that was what really started me down this path of trying to understand how could that happen. But I feel like there are people who kept saying, yeah, but he had everything. He was so good looking. He was so athletic. He was so accomplished. He was so brilliant. He was like, okay, it's lovely to have everything. And it's hard if you have significant, obvious disadvantages, whatever they may be. But everybody is suffering in one way or another, and we have to be open to and receptive to and forgiving of the suffering that other people go through.
No, exactly. And, you know, there was this other piece in the Times headline, a mental health clinic in schools. No thanks, says the school board. And this was in Killingly, wherever that is, Connecticut.
Yes.
And, you know, God forbid, you know, we set things up like we did in Montreal, where there was a mini clinic, including, you know, a consulting psychiatrist, where, I mean, that's the most logical place.
But it's like the idea from Ron DeSantis down in Florida that you shouldn't be allowed to say anything about gayness to children of until they reach a certain age because you might make them gay. Like, you don't make people gay by talking about gayness, and you don't make people suicidal by talking about mental health. People who are suicidal experience great relief when it becomes an open topic. Mm-hmm. People who are gay mitigate the self-hatred that the larger society inflicts on them when people like them are represented in classroom materials. Mm-hmm. I'm not suggesting that we should put aside the rest of the curriculum and focus only on these things. But when you restrict things, and I followed the thing with that school board in Connecticut, and I was so furious about it. I just sort of thought the amount of unnecessary suffering and perhaps likely even death that this is going to inflict, and for what purpose? It's not one of those things where I sort of think, okay, there's a downside, but the upside is there is no upside to what they chose to do. There is no upside to it.
Yeah, no, exactly. You know, I'm thinking when I was at East Hampton High School a couple of months ago, a girl, a junior, she came up to me, we're changing classes, and she says, you know, do you have a couple minutes? I said, I have more than a couple of minutes, you know, what's up? And she says, well, I think I'm bi. I said, okay, you know, tell me about it. You know, I think I like girls, I think I like boys, I'm not sure. I said, so did you, you know, speak to your parents? And she said she did, and they immediately shut her down. And, you know, she said, do you think that there's something wrong with me that I may be bisexual? I says, I think that there's nothing wrong with you that you may be bisexual. And if you want to talk about it. So the next week, you know, I was there every week for 5 weeks. You could just see on this girl, we didn't have another conversation, but there was a sense kind of relief that there was nothing wrong with her. She was, you know, struggling, exploring, not sure, and, you know, that she felt safe enough, secure enough to come up to a stranger, me, and just ask the question. It was like two girls were talking about this, and yeah, okay, you know, you'll see and you'll figure it out. But had she not, maybe she would have gone to her teacher, who's a really great guy, Jim Stewart. Her takeaway would have been, there's something really wrong with me that I even would contemplate the idea of being, you know, bisexual. And this is where we have to, you know, we have to find a way to really educate the educators.
Well, the group of all groups in the United States, there are two groups with the highest rates of youth suicide. People who have been sexually abused, right, of either gender and by anyone, and LGBTQ, yeah, people. And why in this era, when we've made gay marriage the law of the land, despite all of the attempts to push things backward, but when we are at that point, why should we still have LGBTQ people committing suicide in greater numbers than anyone else? It's tragic not to give everyone the sense that, okay, I'm not like you, but you're like you, and have a great time. It's not a complicated message. You don't have to have read Heidegger to get the idea.
No, exactly.
Or Freud.
And I think what you were saying before about parent education, and I'm thinking, because I'm going to be going back to East Hampton High School in the spring, the importance of having regular meetings, seminars with parents about a variety of these kinds of subjects that we are talking about would hopefully help to desensitize them and really give them permission to be able to explore and talk and maybe learn something.
And let me tell you, parents want that permission. Over and over, right, since that article came out, right, people have called me and said, you know, I have a child whom I'm very worried about. Some have said, I have a child whom I've lost. But the number of people who got in touch with me made it clear how broad the problem is. And, you know, now I go out to dinner and people say to me, so tell me what you're working on. And I say, okay, it's a little bit of a downer, but this is what I'm working on. Almost everyone says, oh, I have been so worried about my nephew, or right, says, oh, that happened in my cousin's family and nobody ever understood it. Or people are actually itching to be able to talk about this, but perceive it as so stigmatized that they hold on to secrets, and they could better use their time solving the problems than keeping the secrets.
Right. Talking about the problem of keeping family secrets, you,
yes,
know, isn't that the truth? In fact, I was at a meeting last week with Dani Shapiro, who she says hi, by the way.
Good.
I told her that you were coming on the show. You know, and of course, her latest book is about family secrets. And but no, I think that you gave me a really good idea that I think that at least at East Hampton High School that they're going to probably be very receptive to, is that we should have ongoing parent discussions, meetings about all of this, so at least that population will have an opportunity to educate themselves and, again, to give them permission to be able to reach out and ask for help and ask questions, and that they would feel, you know, so much less alone and alienated. And it's also scary when you're seeing, you know, that your child is going through a really bad time and you're either ashamed or afraid, or you've tried to get help and there's a 6-week, you know, waiting period for an appointment with, you know, with some therapist. And, no, I think that that's a wonderful, wonderful idea. And I wonder whether, you know, again, some of the other schools, the public schools, the private schools around here, whether or not they would be open to doing this kind of parent education, not just talking about the SATs and you know, going to Ivy League schools, but, you know, helping their kids, you know, live the real life that they're living with their concerns and their questions and their crises, of course, that we all go through. I think that, you know, that along with trying to educate the educators
What we need is for there to be demand. You and I can sit here as relative experts and say this needs to be done. If parents, as a large group, began saying, we need this, there are lots of ways to make it happen. If parents are too ashamed to say we need this, then it's not going to happen. We need to, you know, it has to be, you have to stir up the grassroots, and it's hard to do. It's hard to do, but it can be done. It's been done for all kinds of other really civil rights movements. And I feel if we could get women the vote, and if we could eliminate Jim Crow laws, and if we could do all of these other things that we've done, we could pass gay marriage. This could be done too. We just need a groundswell.
No, I think this, you know, these are some really great concrete ideas. You know, I hate this airy fairy. There's a problem. What are we going to do? But this is something very, very, very concrete. I can't believe I'm looking at the producer. It's like 1 minute left. What happened? What happened with this hour? I am so glad to meet you, and I hope that we're going to be able to continue the conversation on the show, off the show. I don't really care. I just want to continue this conversation and get to know you, and I love your writings, and I really admire and respect what you're doing, Andrew. It's great.
Thank you. I admire and respect what you're doing, and I feel very honored to have been chosen for the show and very glad that we could manage it in person.
No, me too. No, and I hope you're feeling better. You look great.
Thank you.
You do. Well, everybody, an hour is come and gone again on the SB show, and I'm going to leave you with my two weekly messages. The first is to do everything that you can possibly do that we all need to do to find ways to do and live what's in our best interest and to love ourselves. And of course, we all need to do a much, 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 much better job in learning to love each other. Goodbye, everybody. Talk to you next week. Take care. Bye-bye.